Well, hello, everyone. This
Love
is Bhakti
Radio.
You're listening to Sangoma. You're listening to Sangoma, Stories from the Frontlines of Mediation. And I've had a little bit of a bobble on the introduction here because when I'm looking at my dashboard for doing the show, we've had a little bit of a false start. It tells me that the show has started and then it hasn't and then it start hasn't. But we're good and we're here. And I'm glad that all of you have joined us today. Rather than doing the usual introduction that I usually do, as I said, we're going to dive right in and start with our interview because I'm so excited to have with me today Adrian Nyangogo. Did I say that? No, Nyongabo.
Yeah.
Ah, Adrian Nyongabo. I've just lost some African cred. but I'm so happy to have Adrian here with me today. We met just this morning, and he's been so gracious and agreed to come onto the show today. I think that it was destined to be. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Wonderful, wonderful. Adrian is here in the United States doing a speaking tour on behalf of an organization that you, I guess, co-founded or helped to found. And he's the coordinator of, and I'd like you to tell us, what is this organization?
My organization is HERO, Healing and Rebuilding Our Communities.
And this is in Burundi specifically?
That's based in Burundi, yes, but we do also work in Rwanda, Congo, Uganda, and Kenya.
Right, and we spent some time this morning at the Breakfast Roundtable at John Jay, which is held on a monthly basis. Different speakers come in. And I wanted to be sure, especially to attend this one, because when I saw the title of it, I was especially intrigued. I think that the folks who are listening are also especially intrigued to hear about how things are going in Burundi, in Rwanda, how things are going with reconciliation and healing. And, you know, I think for myself, at least, I find myself really amazed at what has transpired over the past 20 years or so. Mm-hmm. So tell us, or has it been 10 years?
Yeah, since we started. We started in 2000. We're going to be over 10 years.
Exactly, it's 10 years, right. I'm not sure what date I was thinking of when I was saying 20 years, but 10 years or so. But I want to start out with your story. You know, this show is about stories and the stories of folks who are involved in conflict resolution and peace building. And so I want to know, first of all, what was it like to grow up as a boy? You grew up in Bujumbura?
Yes.
In Burundi?
Right. My childhood was very, very good, enjoyable. I happened just to be in a good family at the beginning. When I was 7 years old, my father left us and I stayed with my mom. So I have one brother and two sisters, so mom raised a single parent. Being a child in a community where I was accepted by everybody, I could not just mind not seeing dad around because everybody was just taking care of me or my brother and my sisters. That was the life in Bujumbura, you know, or the city, and we went to school, we were just playing as kids together without problem at all. Until when I just, you know, went to high school, or we say secondary school in Burundi, and that's when things started to be different from what they used to be.
How do you become aware of there being a difference?
That was when the elections, no, we were just around 1985, 86. Mm-hmm. At that time, they started to do this multi-party system. And I noticed within the school, in our school, which was a very, very nice school, you know, students starting just to bring this notion of Hutu and the Tutsi as the political party were very sensitive to that. It's true that with our government was very restricted not to base on ethnicity, but still one will just behave according to the group he or she belongs to.
So it's something like at high school you become aware of having that particular ethnic or political identity. I mean, we can talk about the sort of tension with the idea of using the word ethnicity to describe the situation. Mm-hmm. I remember this morning you talked about how that all started and why it's kind of puzzling that Hutu, Tutsi,
and Twa
are considered ethnicities when one considers where the names came from.
Mm-hmm.
But we can talk about that in a moment. But I'm understanding that then in high school, you start to have an idea of yourself as being labeled in a particular way. Tell me about that.
Yeah, actually, it was very difficult for me because I didn't know, you know, to really belong to one group. I had friends from both sides. So when they start saying, okay, you need to find your group, I just, you know, I remember I was just in vacation, and I was asking my mom, you know, I told her about what happened at school, and then I asked her who I am, you know. I need to know if I am a Tutsi or I'm a Hutu. And she told me that, you know, you are Hutu because your father is a Hutu. So from that time, I happened just to know that we are on our father's side. Was it good for me? Not at all. You know, or like, do I want just to be really on the Hutu side when I am used to, you know, having, you know, chatting time? You know, we just, you know, decided together, Tutsi and Hutus, we're playing soccer, football together, playing basket, ping pong. I had really no problem with any. But with that time, you know, they started to really having this kind of private meetings. They might be on this, but I can just assure you, I never participated in any of such meetings.
Mm.
I stayed on my side. I just meet everybody on the pitch, playing in the refectory or just for dinner at school. That's all. I really hated that.
What were your friends saying about it?
Sometimes they're just saying, oh, Adrian is strange. Of course I'm strange because my mom is a Tutsi. So I didn't want just to say I'm different from my mom. That was the thing which was in me. But I didn't just tell them, okay, because of this and that, that's why I don't want to join either one. But I kept inside of me, knowing what I am. I say, all right, you can do your thing, and they can do their thing, but I am in the middle.
Mm-hmm. So being in the middle, in your heart, right, but then on the outside, there is a pressure, I suppose,
yes,
that you're supposed to behave a certain way or only hang out with certain people, you know, only associate with certain people. In your communities, let's say in your neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
how did this impact, you know, so you say it's the beginning of a multi-party system that brings it, at least to your mind, the mm-hmm. understanding mm-hmm. that there are these divisions. Describe what was going on in your neighborhood as far as that was concerned.
Yeah, there is this, we have two main political parties, UPRONA and the FRODEBU.
Mm-hmm.
So FRODEBU was known as the Hutu majority party.
Mm-hmm.
And UPRONA, which used to be the unique ruling party before the multi-party system, it was just majority Tutsi. So whoever was on the Iprona side, though many Hutus were just on the Iprona side, they were just qualified to be friends of Tutsi or Tutsi. And the affordable one was just the Hutu side. Frankly, I am not really that politician. That's it's not something which is in me. So I was not interested in politics. That's one. Second, while at school, I really, you know, I was just joking with those students saying, you know, we are on this side. I would just make a joke, and because we used to just be together, doing everything together, and they're just joking, why are you bringing such a thing? But I also made sure that I don't, wound anybody, you know, by just saying that. I don't know. Something special in me pushed me not to take a stand. Like, I am just on the side, but I choose to be in the middle. That's something I cannot call you. I don't know how to describe it, but it was really in me.
You say that folks, you know, your friends said you're different, and you explained why. When it came to your friends taking a stand, how did they express?
You know, it was kind of rivalry. Some were just proud saying, we're going to win. know, the Hutu are just saying, we want to just take power from you, Tutsi, because you have been ruling for so many years, not to our term. And the Hutu are just saying, no, how? We've been ruling, we keep ruling because we are used to that. And that's why, you know, things were. And even at the beginning, it was like a joke. Mm-hmm. And the two sides were like, you know, playing tennis ball, one throwing the ball and the one throwing the other ball. So they just, you know, sometimes they injured, you know, said bad words mm-hmm. to one another.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way of saying, I want just to pull you down, you know, wait, the election day, I'm going to show who I am. So things like that. And I listen to such a kind of discussion. I say, what? What? I mean, I was not aware of what it was going to be after the election, but in me, I took, the right decision. And I'm really thankful to myself that instant that was in me, not just to say, I want to just be on this side, on that one. Instead, I just keep neutral.
In the middle. You know, I think this might be a moment for us to step back a little bit further so that folks who are not familiar with Rwanda, Burundi in particular we're talking about today, and the issue of ethnic identity and where this all came from, with Hutus and Tutsis and Twa people, you know, how did it all start?
Of course. Hutu, Tutsi, and Twa are both Kirundi words. So, for sure, Burundians were using or have been using those things, or those words since I don't know when. And we learned Hutu and Tutsi and Twa were categories describing what one was doing. Tutsis were just known as people who own cows. And Hutus were just servants, and Twa were just making pots.
So could a person who was a Hutu for a period of their life become a Tutsi?
Exactly, exactly. If I happen to increase my richness, I will have servants. So I'm no longer a Hutu, but I'm going to be a Tutsi of the Hutu who are just serving me. The same way, a Tutsi who used to have a be wealth and rich, he might just, you know, lose his possessions, and then he becomes poor. So he will just work for somebody else. And that time, he becomes a Hutu of somebody.
So the terms really are describing status.
Exactly.
Rather than identity, ethnicity, and that sort of thing.
There was no.
And the Twa?
The Twa were just considered as a category on the law side, and on working or making pots. That was. And it remained that way up to very, very recently, 1980s and
1970s. Mm. So it is conceivable then that a person who was born into a family that was called Twa could end their life being a Tutsi?
I haven't heard such a thing happen.
Uh-huh.
What I heard about Twa, they were not really that integrated in the community.
Okay.
They were considering themselves not equal to Hutu or Tutsi.
Okay.
And they were nomads.
Mm-hmm.
They were just moving from one place to another.
Okay.
So that's how it was very difficult to see a Twa emerging. But you would see Hutu really becoming something else, and Tutsis also becoming poor in our community.
But and it's interesting you mentioned that, because in the media and the news that we received over here, one never heard of Twa.
It's unjust. You know, it's one of the categories or identities we have in Burundi and in Rwanda. They should be known.
And they're not, because you know, everything was about a clash between, and clash is such a mild term, but, you know, between Hutus and Tutsis, and one never heard about Twa.
Yeah, that's maybe the consequences of power fighting,
mm-hmm.
you know, when the Twa were not claiming for anything, and they thought maybe they are not there. But I'm thankful to my government for now. They have made laws which really give room to Twa people.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there are seats reserved to Twa in the parliament and senate. So they make sure that they are included. So that's one way of letting them know that they are part of Burundians. So what happened during the crisis, that's true. There is nothing to do with Twa because they were not chasing either Hutu or Tutsi. Instead, they were victim or they were their victim in case they were just attacked in that community, or they supported one side in case they were just asked to do that. So there was really main two sides, Hutu or Tutsi fighting.
So talk to me about how these statuses now become an ethnicity.
The main influence was from the colonizers. Really, they were smart to the point they transformed the category or the way of identifying people based on what they were doing into ethnicity. But it's unbelievable how we can say we have ethnicities in Burundi when all the three groups speak one language. All the three groups can have the same names. They have the same culture. You know, we have been living in the same communities almost for years and years. And then we come to say we have ethnicities. Anthropologically, sociologically, that's not verified.
So I can imagine it being sort of like in the United States, if all the doctors and lawyers all of a sudden are one ethnicity, and all the teachers and nurses are a different ethnicity, and all the people who perhaps are janitors are a different ethnicity. Now all of a sudden we're basing ethnicity along that kind of line.
Yeah, maybe you'll be basing on what one gains or makes per day, saying, okay, if you make this amount per day, you are this
ethnicity now.
Yeah, that was ridiculous.
Wow.
That was very ridiculous. But the reality is, you know, I think they were trying just to explain how these two, three groups can be known. Just to based on the economic thing we say before was not sufficient for them.
Now, why did they care?
That was the strategy of the colonizer. How could they just divide and then rule? So they introduced such a kind of ethnicity just to have one ethnicity which is superior to another. So that you see that once one way of thinking or psychiatrist is somehow transformed. I am superior. I am no longer the same. Even though I may just lose my possessions and so on, I feel superior to the one who has been on the lower class. So they started to introduce such a thing. Maybe they based on the realities they have in Europe. You know, those things were just really out there. And they were just using them, and they brought that copy to Burundi. They succeeded, and Burundians believed in it. Up to now, we consider that there are three ethnic groups.
Well, now tell me, though, you say that you're talking about people who speak the same language, may share the same name. How do you tell the difference between a Hutu and a Tutsi, or how did the colonizers in this instance, we're talking about Belgium, right?
Yeah.
So how did the Belgians come in and decide who's going to be a Hutu, who's going to be a Tutsi, who's Twa?
Yeah, to be frank, if you go to the extreme, you can say, okay, the type of person they took, you know, to be a Tutsi, being a tall, wrong face, narrow nose, those people are there. You can find them. And Hutu is a strong, round face, large nose, not very tall, they are there. You know? So if you can just base on these two, of course, you're going to have samples. But what is in between? You know? Just I just reminds me, my headmaster, he was just a twin. So they went to Belgium, to France. And they went to fence, and they said, you know, his other brother, his other twin.
His twin brother.
Yeah, his twin brother. They're very short. Between you two, who's the Hutu and who's the Tutsi? And, you know, he was just saying,
a joke.
You know, yeah. We're just learning about this Hutu and the Tutsi. They say, please, my students, be aware of such a thing. That's not really based on the reality. You know, my twin brother was called a Hutu because of, you know, his hate. But we are all Tutsis. We're all Tutsis.
So he was called a Hutu. Your headmaster is called a Tutsi.
Yeah, and his twin
and
brother.
His twin brother was called a Hutu.
A Hutu.
So, I mean, that if there's any example of how ridiculous
exactly.
it was, there you have it.
That's what brought even the Belgians into confusion. When they're just trying to really be sure who's a Hutu and the Tutsi, to the point where they based on the number of cows one had to become a Hutu or Tutsi.
So you come and you count cows.
Sure. I mean, you know, cows are just symbol of richness.
Of course, yeah.
And just to be reconsidered in the society, you had to have a cow. And as Tutsi was just the group, or the ethnic group, made ethnic group superior to the others, you had to own a cow. So they based on that saying, okay, whoever has more than 10 cows is a Tutsi. Sometimes, I don't know, maybe going back and looking at what colonization has really done to colonize, we need to think twice and maybe look at what they needed or what they were looking for at that time. Even if we can have a dialogue with them, they can maybe tell us the truth, why they were just doing that. I believe they are so educated. And they have been in school, and many of them are good professors. They can just say, no, this is not real. You know, we did this for this purpose. And for Africans, they can really, I think, they can really say, oh, we now understand why they did this. There was no way of saying, you are different ethnicities. Instead, we want you to really catch you.
So it was about power.
Only power.
Yeah.
Only power.
Yeah. Wow. So let's come forward a bit. We're back with you in high school,
mm-hmm.
and the elections are coming. It's the first multi-party elections.
Yeah.
The elections happened.
Yeah.
And what happens then?
Elections happened. You know, whoever was 18 and over years old was allowed to go and vote. Actually, the election itself was so peaceful and very, very good, well organized. It was the after election period that was somehow not very nice. In which ways? One, the former Unique Party was expecting to win the Tutsi side because they have been on power for many years, and in their campaign, many people were just attending their meetings. They thought, oh, for sure we're going to win. But the results were different. So they lost. That was a shock on the Tutsi side. Of course, on the Hutu side, majority Hutu side was
ecstatic, I'm sure.
Yeah. I say, yes, we made it. We had the first Hutu president. And himself was very inclusive. In his speeches, what he was doing was very to bring people together, and he was we need to embrace democracy, and democracy allows the differences to cooperate.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, there have been some things which were not, you know, going that way, you know, but still, they were just doing something, I mean, that could have helped Burundi. 3 months after the election, now, the president was assassinated by the Tutsi majority army.
So he takes office and he comes into a government that really is dominated by Tutsis anyway.
Then the government he made, you know, was not dominated by Tutsi.
Okay.
It was a majority Hutu, I think.
The government that he brings in, but when you're talking about the civil service,
yeah.
You know, who was dominating the civil service? at that point.
At that top Albania was the Tutsi.
Yeah.
You know, they were Tutsi, yeah. Of course. You know, the changes that were taking place, you know, some of the Tutsi were also upset to be, you know, taken off.
Sure,
you know?
Yeah.
So that created another frustration. Is it linked to that assassination or not? I don't know. But what I know is 3 months after that, he was assassinated. Mm.
And so, you know, I'm imagining you and your friends, you're in high school, the elections happen, it's an exciting time, the elections are peaceful, and then you wake up one the morning, you know, 3 months later, and you hear on the news that he's been assassinated. Mm. What went through your mind?
You know, I still remember that the national radio TV broadcast didn't operate that day, which is a symbol of something on the high level has happened.
Something really wrong.
Wrong happened.
Yeah.
And I got threatened as Burundian, many Burundians were. And we're just saying, oh, president has been caught, and we don't know if he died or not. And then other radio stations from Rwanda or BBC or Radio France were just, you know, broadcasting the news about Burundi. That's how we follow the situation. Later on, they say that the president really died.
Mm.
Yes. So I want just to share that first we knew that something wrong happened, and we didn't know that the president had been assassinated. And along the day, we knew that the president died. It was like 9 p.m. That's when we heard about it. You see, there was kind of waiting time.
Mm.
And just to say, really, we were not quite in a good mood. So, you know, we can just link that to the campaign period, election, where the two groups very, very excited, one on his side, and then the election, the one who was expecting to win has lost. Just this, I mean, is this very, very, very in shock. And those who are excited, they have just lost the president. Now things are mixed up.
So tensions are really high, emotions are really high.
On both sides.
Yes.
On both sides.
So what happened?
After that, we witnessed to the massive killings.
Mm.
Yeah, there is one case which is still really very, very known by everybody in Burundi. The killing of students and the teachers, Tutsi students and the teachers in Kibimba, where they were burned alive on 22nd October. The president died on 21st October.
And the next day.
Yeah.
And so, obviously, it's a retaliation.
Right. It's a retaliation, and I don't know. That spontaneity, I personally understand that things can go that way.
Hmm.
But many others will say, no, things were planned ahead of time.
You know, I wanted to ask you about that because as a human being, and then as a person who, I mean, I have a very multicultural identity, having been born in South Africa and then also growing up in the United States. So, you know, I have a little bit of knowledge, a little bit more than a little bit of knowledge about South Africa and about Southern African people and about African people, if you want to go that broad.
Yeah.
That, you know, I can say that my my friends and folks that I know who are Americans and haven't traveled and so forth, you know, don't have. And even I am at a loss to understand how that happens.
Mm.
It was just so, I mean, just unimaginable and incredible.
Mm.
And I'm wondering how it is for you and your neighbors and your friends to be hearing this news of these massacres happening and trying to make sense of it.
Mm.
You know, can it make sense? I mean, culturally speaking, I mean, it's not part of the culture.
Right.
It's not, where does it come from?
I would say it doesn't make sense whenever one dies after being executed or killed by his countrymate. It doesn't. But if you analyze the history, you can link to such a kind of action to what happened, how people haven't had time to process kind of hard emotions and feelings that have been really, I would say, boiling and burning inside of them. And, something happens and it just triggers everything.
Mm-hmm.
And one can just act like a mad person.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I just give an explanation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not just saying, okay, whatever happened just was instinctive. No, I'm just trying to find how could they be connected to whatever happened in the past and was not resolved. If the 1993 elections made the former ruling party to lose, how the losers digested this feeling, this shock, did they have a time really to process that? Say no.
Mm-hmm.
If the Hutus, after the assassination of the president, killed Tutsi, have they had time to digest what happened in 1972? Because many of those, the adults by that time, were orphans.
In 1972. Tell us what happened in 72.
Oh, in 72, that's another Hutu-Tutsi issue. In 72, there was a group of Hutu. I say that Hutu were just majority. They were just ruled by Tutsi.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, let me tell you first, because Rwanda and Burundi are so, they are neighbors,
mm-hmm.
and they have both Hutu, Tutsi, and Twa.
Let me ask this. Before colonization, was there a border between Rwanda and Burundi?
They were two separate kingdoms.
They were definitely separate and separate identities. People understand. Yeah.
Yeah, but when they were given to Belgium, the Belgians made them one colony.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, Rwanda, Burundi.
Uh-huh.
It was just as one colony.
Okay.
Yes. That was another issue. But anyway, when the Rwanda, Burundi, they asked for independence as two separated countries, Rwanda, Burundi. In 1959, in Rwanda, Hutu took power from Tutsi.
Mm.
And many Tutsi were really badly killed.
Mm.
Those who escaped went to Burundi or Congo or Tanzania and Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I'm just trying to bring you to 1972 in Burundi.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever happened in Rwanda, Hutu taking power from Tutsi was kind of, why not you guys in Burundi? You can't do well with that. So, in Burundi, there was a kind of a coup in 1972 organized by Hutu, and they failed.
Mm-hmm.
With the failure, the current government organized this really selective assassination of all educated Hutus, either students who are still at school or civil servants,
professors,
teachers, doctors, everyone who was in Burundi were just targeted.
Mm.
Yeah, many of them really died. Yeah, they say, some say around 200,000 or 300,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
I did not realize it was that big.
Yes. Yeah. True.
So now you've got the orphans of those people.
Yeah.
fast forwarding now to 1993,
mm-hmm.
you have the orphans of those people now living the aftermath of the Hutu president being assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
And now you talked about the school.
Mm-hmm.
And I should make note, it was a Quaker school.
It was a Quaker school.
And yeah. you yourself yeah. Are a Quaker.
I am a Quaker.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about HROC and,
sure.
and the involvement of Quakers with that.
Right.
But you started to say that there's some question as to whether that was planned.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Many were just asking themselves, was it planned or not?
Mm.
But my analysis is just to look at and what unresolved conflict, what unresolved feelings can lead one to.
Mm. Right.
Whatever. If they have had meanings, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to look at what happened before and it was not really treated and people didn't acknowledge what happened for the victims just to feel comforted. You know, instead they kept such a kind of anger, grief inside of them. And maybe that's what led them to whatever happened.
Mm.
And after the assassination, the president and the Hutu killing the Tutsi, the army came in just as avenging, you know, by killing...
It's a Tutsi-dominated army now
yes.
coming.
Yeah, uh-huh. yeah. killing Hutus in the villages and Colines. And from there, that's when we started to have Hutu armed groups
mm.
just to fight against the Tutsi dominant army in Burundi.
So now you really have a civil war.
Was. That was the beginning. That was really the beginning. You might hear in this communal province, people died. You know that there are Tutsi if they have been attacked in the IDP, internal displaced persons camp, and you just hear another person, another community, another commune have been attacked. If there is no IDP, you will just hear, okay, these people who died are Hutus.
Mm.
So that was back and forth mm-hmm. between the armed groups and the army, national army.
Let's step back a little bit and describe this a little further, because you've mentioned the IDP. So
mm-hmm.
how did the IDPs come around? What is an IDP? You said it's internally displaced persons camp.
Yes.
So how do those come about?
That was a way to protect Tutsi of being killed as this Hutu Tutsi killing started.
Mm-hmm.
They were just taken from the villages or their communities, and put into a settlement where they were protected by the police.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we start to have these internal displaced persons.
Now, you mentioned earlier your mom is a Tutsi.
Mm-hmm.
You are identified as Hutu
mm-hmm.
based on your father, and that's what your mother told you.
Mm-hmm.
But then you've got your mother's family, which would include uncles, aunts, grandparents, and so forth.
Mm.
What happens in your family in a situation like that?
Mm.
I'm imagining that the Tutsi part of the family has to go to the IDP.
Mm.
The Hutu part of the family stays. I mean, how does this happen in real... Or what is the impact in really real terms on a family?
The IDPs were settled not in all the country.
Okay.
No, in some region. For example, the southern part of Burundi doesn't have any IDPs.
Okay.
But if you go to central and north,
mm-hmm.
that's where really, we have so many IDP camps. So doesn't mean if you come from Hutu Tutsi families, you find some in the IDP. Yes, you can find them in the IDP if they are located where IDPs are.
Mm-hmm.
But they can still live in the communities if in that commune or province nothing wrong happened.
Mm.
It was really strange. We have a Hutu and a Tutsi, for example, in Bururi and Bujumbura kind of. Yeah, Bujumbura was separated. It was not IDPs, but the Saba
mm-hmm.
became reprised.
Mm.
Hutu Saba and the Tutsi Saba. And if you are Hutu living in a suburb, majority Tutsi, you have to leave for your safety. If not, you were killed. Many were just killed. We really witnessed that in Bujumbura. So So having my mom, and I told you that my dad was no longer there, she was there, and she also to leave, and I lived, she had to flee the Sabbath. Anyway, it was mixed up somehow, and I don't know. You just find a way where to stay, either stay with the family, where they can just accept you, or be in IDP. In Bujumbura, there was no permanent IDP. They were just housed by either friends. One time they were just, put in, this stadium or schools, but after 1 month or 2 months, they were just asked if to leave because the schools were just going to start. That's how things were in Bujumbura mostly. But in the remote area of Burundi, still up now, we have IDP.
So you describe a situation then where the president has been assassinated, there's retaliation by Hutus, the Tutsi majority army comes in, people now are arming themselves with militias, so you have civil war going on. How long does this last?
Up to 2003. That's when we had our ceasefire signed between the current government and the CNDD-FDD. But see, after the ceasefire, that first ceasefire, because we had two, there was another armed group, FNL.
Okay.
So they didn't sign that first one. But it was really signed after 2005. So just to say, openly, the open fighting was just stopped in 2003, and we had our first, after 93, the first elections came in 2005. But still, the FNL was still in the bush fighting.
Okay.
So many people, some people died in Tunda, and it was 2006 or 2007, kind of, or 8. That's when another ceasefire was signed between the current government and the FNL. I would say since then, we haven't had kind of FNL killing.
Right. Now, that's where we come to the work that you're doing, and then also thinking about, why does the ceasefire happen when it happens? How is it that things have not flared up since then? And what lessons can be taken from that to make sure that the status quo, well, not the status quo necessarily, you might expect that politically things might change one way or another, but that you're not going to return to having a situation of civil war, mass killings, and so forth. So I'm curious to understand what is going on now on a community level as people in Burundi process what has happened, restore normalcy, I suppose, to their lives. And I'm imagining it's a brand new normal because you can't discount the impact of the civil war on people today and on communities today.
I would say on the community level, there are so many initiatives which are led to help in rebuilding the communities, in healing the individuals and the communities as a whole. Even just after 1993, there were people who really worked hard. In Kibimba itself, when I said the killing started, they were so brave people who really came and tried to have the two sides back together in the whole time, where they were still killing. Yeah, that's the first Kibimba Peace Committee. That's where they started. There was this...
Is this a mixed group?
It was a mixed group. They were helped by a Mennonite person. I forget her name. She went there, and she tried to work with two Hutu and two Tutsi by just visiting one another. They were just Tutsi on one side, and Hutus were just now, they could not stay in their home because at any time they were going to be killed. So they were either staying in the Varis or hiding themselves in the bushes. So, but she managed just to have, you know, those representatives, and from there, they would just go at the mobile clinic, because she was working at the hospital. The mobile clinic, treating the Tutsis who were in the IDPs, could not go to the hospital, and also treating the Hutus who were in the valleys and the bush, because they could not go to the clinic. And from there, she started just to have this inter-community visit. So that's one thing I can say, that such initiatives started very, very just after the event.
Mm-hmm.
But now, there are many groups, including my organization, which are really trying to bring the two groups, not only the two groups, because we have had now demobilized and ex-combatants, we have had refugees who are now coming in. So, you see, it's not only the killings between Hutu and Tutsi. There are other aspects of community life which are now asking for to be taken care of.
You know, I want to ask this question as you're talking about the decommissioned people and former combatants and so forth. In your work, you must speak with people who took part in the killings. It's going to sound like a really... It might sound like a really simplistic question, but I mean, I have a very specific reason for asking it. Do they know why they were killing?
They know why. Maybe yes, maybe no. Actually, when we go to a community, we don't know who killed or who didn't.
Mm-hmm.
What we know is that killings happened in that community.
Mm-hmm.
So we invite with our healing companions, ask them just to select 20 people, 10 from one side and 10 from the other side. So once we are together, we learn about these trauma issues and how we can deal with a strong emotion. Afterward, we look at how can we rebuild the broken trust. From those exercises and lessons, people just come to sharing what happened. And some will just say, okay, things which were done this way, I know who did it. I am the one who did it. So they reveal themselves, but we ahead of time we don't know. Of course, there are some who took cows, those are known, because when they are them, they were just okay, you are eating the cow of this somebody. Remember, when things will be calm down, you have just to pay for.
Yes,
so there are such people who are known. I will not be surprised if even those old kids are still not home. Because there are people who escaped,
mm-hmm.
and they saw everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a matter of maybe fearing what may
mm-hmm.
happen,
mm-hmm.
or I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But still, if somebody has done something wrong, he's not known. His or her consciousness, we keep just condemning him.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that, because I want to make sure, you know, I'm looking at the time and we have just over 10 minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
Although, if you will indulge me, we could tape for longer than that.
Right,
so
right.
In about 10 minutes, for the folks who are listening live, the show will end.
Right.
We could continue talking if you'd like, and people can come back and listen to that portion of it after it has been broadcasted. So,
sure.
You know, we can see how things go.
Mm.
But I want to make sure that folks understand what you're doing with healing and
rebuilding
our communities.
Mm.
How does it work? You know, I hear that there's a workshop, a three-day workshop and so forth. So what do you do when you come into a community and what kinds of things do you experience there?
We conduct those workshops. That's the first step.
Mm-hmm.
What happens in the workshop? Sometimes when we tell people what happened in a workshop, you might think it's not real.
Mm.
But as somebody who has been in many workshops, I really tell you it's real, it did happen. And people are very eager to really change,
mm-hmm.
and ask for forgiveness. And even if they don't ask for forgiveness, there are those who are willing to offer forgiveness.
Even if it hasn't been asked.
Right.
So describe to me this the steps of the workshop. But if I were to be coming to a workshop, what would happen when I arrive?
Yeah, day one, we will focus on understanding trauma. You know, what are the trauma causes? What are the symptoms of trauma? And what are the consequences of trauma? And after we have seen those, we look at how trauma can affect one, how trauma can affect the family, how trauma can affect the community,
mm-hmm.
and how those three levels are interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
So we say it's true. We need to look for individual healing, but also we know that if the community is not healed, the individual will also be wounded again. If the family is not healed, the individual will just become also wounded. So I want to make sure that we are touching on the three levels as we look for healing.
Mm-hmm.
That's day one. Day two, we base mostly on managing strong emotions. And the emotions we consider the most are the anger and grief. Those, when you hear people sharing their stories, they mostly base on anger. They mostly base on the bitterness, you know, which is the grief. And they haven't been able to process. So we learn to give how can we manage those emotions. How can we express them in a way it doesn't destroy others
mm-hmm.
or destroy ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that's day two. Day three, we are based on rebuilding trust. You know, before we learn how you can rebuild the broken trust, we need to know what is mistrust. And when we talk about mistrust, you will find people coming back to the causes of the war, things that cause them to kill each other,
mm-hmm.
things that cause to destroy their houses, to burn their houses, things that cause just really to separate. And we look at the tree of trust. What is trust?
Mm-hmm.
How can we look at the roots of trust? And people come back to the normal, simple things they used to do, like, you know, when they want to start fire, for example. Not everybody has matches. But once one in the neighborhood has started the fire, everybody will just come and drop a burning chalk and start fire after.
Yeah.
You know, that's simple. But after the crisis, people were not willing to do that
mm-hmm.
because they were just suspicious about the other and they were just worried that, you know, something wrong may happen in somebody's kitchen. So I'm not really feeling free to go in.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, those are the 3 days workshop we do, and the lessons or items we base on are the ones I mentioned.
Now, the results can be tremendously powerful, and you told us 2 stories this morning that I found especially compelling. One is about Prospero,
yeah.
And then I want to know about the goats.
The goats.
So,
yeah, the goats.
Can we start with Prospero?
Yes. I don't know how to say he's a hero,
mm-hmm.
you know, taking such a decision after he had lost everyone in his family and to make a decision of asking the mother to become his brother. Just the only thing he asked him, can you accept to become my brother? Everything I have really forgotten, I'm ready to forgive you. But accept me as your brother.
You know, I was listening to the room as you told this story, and it became so quiet. People who had been coughing stopped coughing, you know, because it really is quite stunning. So what you relayed was that this person named Prospero,
yeah.
His family was murdered around
yeah.
him,
yeah.
basically,
yeah.
and he
yeah.
was supposed to be dead too.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
that the person who killed his family made a mistake, in a sense, and left him alive, thinking that he was dead.
He thought he was dead.
He thought he was dead. But Prospero knew the person
yeah.
who killed his family,
mm-hmm.
and after taking the workshop,
mm-hmm.
decides to go and find him.
Right. Yes.
And since Prospero has lost his entire family,
mm-hmm.
no mother, no father, no brothers, nothing, he is without a family, and so he goes to the man who murdered his family and says, okay, you become my family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he asked him. That's all, the only thing he asked him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you accept to become my brother? Because I have no brother, I have no sister, I have no father, no mom. You will be my only brother. That's amazing. I myself, I was you know, when he told me such a thing, you see, that is good. I mean, I cannot believe that it came from the workshop. But he was saying that was from the workshop.
Mm-hmm.
I felt so deep touched to the point I wanted to really be with him.
Because one thing that I think can get overlooked in a conventional sense
mm-hmm.
is what is happening with the person who has committed the attraction,
mm-hmm.
who has participated in the attraction. We have so much focus on survivors.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm imagining what must be happening when Prospero approaches this man and says, hey, remember when you tried to kill me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, actually, that's what he says. The first day, you know, the guy jumped, he wanted to run away.
Yeah.
He said, no, I'm greeting you with a good heart. He said, no, boy, you won't just get me. He said, please, be quiet. So Prospero just explaining me how it took him 2 days to get the guy.
Mm.
Yeah. Even before, he had such intention of just, you know, asking him that thing, but whenever he wanted to cross him, he would just take another path.
So he literally had to chase this man down.
Uh-huh.
And get him to talk to him and say no.
Yes.
So what are things like now? Or at least the last time you spoke with Prospero,
you cannot believe we are now friends, we are brothers. I send my kids to his family. They stay there for another 2 or 3 days. He sent his kids to my home in the IDP. We have brothers.
Mm.
So they decided, and they have decided.
Mm-hmm.
And such a thing, we just, I don't know how the Truth and the Reconciliation Commission can just, you know, take into account such a kind of forgiveness which have taken place before, you know, instead of going in the, you know, in the country, in the community, saying, we want to start forgiveness and so on and so on. I would rather advise the TRC commissioners just to consult with these local NGOs who have been doing so amazing work.
For all these years.
Yeah, for these years, to ask them how things are. Because there are cases where people really did kill and have forgiven each other,
mm-hmm.
and now they are back together.
Amazing.
Absolutely.
I mean, beyond, there's not a word for it. And we all sat there in stunned silence going, wow.
No, that was my case. When the first person told me that,
yeah.
You know, I look in the sky. But somewhere I came to understand.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can make a choice.
Yeah.
And we are capable of that.
Yeah.
No matter whatever happened to us. Can make a choice.
Yeah.
That's the only thing one still owns. Yeah, you can make a choice.
You say that in the workshop, one of the things that you talk about is I can be another person.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. After trauma,
mm-hmm.
you know, we become traumatized. We become this person who sees, who views things according to his or her understanding. And so often, you find that all things which are done in those cases are really very destructive
mm-hmm.
and harmful,
mm-hmm.
not only to the entourage or the surroundings, even to the person himself.
Yes. Okay.
So once the person finds a way to recognize how destructive and harmful his or her behaviors have been, he or she can say, no,
mm-hmm.
I want just to be.
Mm-hmm.
That is how I say, you can become another person.
Mm-hmm.
You can just choose to live in another home.
Mm-hmm.
The home where you're going to get peace.
Mm-hmm.
Peace of mind. Peace of heart. And you'll be a model in your society, in your community, in your family. That would really make me to be proud of Europe when I hear all those testimonies and how people are changing. And others are also asking them, how did you come to that? I said, go to Europe.
Mm.
Go to Hero.
Yes.
So that.
Right, and Hero, of course, is healing our
and healing
and rebuilding our community.
Yes.
Right. So we're coming down to the last sort of 30 seconds of the scheduled part of the show. You and I, of course, are going to continue talking.
No problem.
I invite the folks who are listening to come back to the website and listen to the rest of the interview, and it will be available actually about 30 minutes after we finish, or you can come back tomorrow. So we'll post the links up, and we invite you to come back. So let's talk about the goats.
Goats. Yeah, the goats was an idea which came from the widows group.
Yes.
And they had attended our hero workshop. And they wrote me a letter saying, you know, Adrian, you had so much, you know, as we learn how to deal with this trauma and how we can share our stories, but we want just to do some kind of agriculture and so on. They had the land, a piece of land. They're just cultivating, you know, beans and the potatoes, but the harvest was not that good because the soil is really poor. Erosion is bad. They asked first for money to buy these chemical fertilizers. And I said, oh, boy, I don't have money for that. You know, the little money I have is just for the workshops. That's how we, you know, we run our organization. But anyway, I said, that's an idea. And they said, no, but, I mean, could you find goats for us so that we can have manure for the field?
Which I will tell you from a personal perspective is much better than the chemical fertilizers because, you know, we have issues with the chemical. So, you know, just a little aside. But,
right.
Okay.
Yeah, you know better than I do.
Not necessarily, but I'll tell you that the idea of using chemicals in food is quite a concern here in the States at the moment. So
I hope my country will know that because...
Yeah.
You know, it's something out there.
Yeah.
Anyway, I say, all right, but I don't have money for goats, you know. But on one of my trips to the States, I talked to a Quaker meeting in Orientia, which is in Washington State, and they seemed interested by the project. And they asked how many goats would they want. As they haven't told me how many, I just asked the woman group, how many goats do you want? I said, 12. So I wrote back to the Orientia man and said, they asked me for 12. And the Orientia friend said, why only 12? You know? And she said, okay, we can offer them 40. So they send money for 40 goats. I went back to Pastor Sarah, who's the leader of the group. I say, okay, you have money for 40 goats, but you need to tell me how you're going to raise all those 40 goats. Are you going just to put in one home and find somebody who's going to pasture them or what? She's amazing. And he said, no, Adrian, we have another idea. We will just give one goat to two women, a Tutsi and a Hutu. By the way, when people hear here saying Tutsi, they think all Tutsi are rich. No way. Things have been the other way. Not only Hutus are just, you know, servants, as you say. Hutu and the Tutsi have been just cultivating, walking the land. You know, there are poor Hutu, there are poor Tutsi, as they are rich Hutu and they are rich Tutsi.
Mm-hmm.
When you are in the countryside, all those people are in the bad shape.
Hmm.
Really bad shape. Anyway, that's a reminder. She said, okay, we're going to give one to a Hutu and a Tutsi. And we ask them to raise a goat together.
Hmm.
Meaning, they just keep visiting each other and asking how the goat is doing. Actually, that's the common greeting. How's your goat?
How's
the goat?
Oh,
I have to know. Yes, you need to tell me how the goat is. You know, that's where my heart is.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
See?
So they share a common interest in the goat.
Yeah.
So the goat stays at one person's plot?
Yeah, house.
Uh-huh.
And once they have the first kid,
uh-huh.
You know, they're ready to give the mother and the kid.
Okay.
Once the kid has grown enough and to be by her or his own,
uh-huh.
The kid is given to one of the partners,
okay.
And the other gets the mother.
Uh-huh.
Once you have gotten the mother, the goat is yours.
Okay.
But you are not allowed to sell it before the goat gives another kid.
Yeah.
That's the rule.
Okay.
You see? Okay. Because there will be many who say, oh, now I have a God, I can just say it.
Yes.
No. You have to have at least one God from the Hirok cycle.
Okay. And so that one out of the two women, you end up with two goats.
Yeah.
Okay.
So once the kid is given to the other partner,
mm-hmm.
they look for another friend in the community. Who's gonna be a new friend to the partner.
Right.
So there's another new team.
Okay.
Raising the kid as a giver.
Right.
So if it's a male kid,
mm-hmm.
they just sell it and we buy a female.
Okay.
That's the rule.
Okay.
So it's now, you know, it's still going on. We're on the seventh generation.
Wow.
Yes. It's amazing. I mean,
how many women are involved, you know?
At the beginning we just 80. There were 100. No, she was able to give the 40 goats to 80 women.
Mm-hmm.
So 20 were just waiting.
Mm-hmm.
So now the 20 have been served.
Right.
So they include not only widows, because it was just a widow group.
Mm-hmm.
But now, even those who are not widows, women, are just joining the group.
Mm-hmm.
Because so much is happening in the group that everybody wants just to, you know, to join.
Right.
So now they're just including whoever is in that community. What? I was just saying, when we give, you know, such a kind of opportunity to people to increase their economic status, you know, you may think, oh, no, how long this going to take for
mm-hmm.
one to get a goal?
Mm-hmm.
But I realized how important it is to somebody to know that you have all the time. You own something.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it creates a sense of joy and empowerment you cannot believe.
Well, I think it goes a little bit beyond that, because I think some people might come and say, not only is it, you know, how long is it going to take for these generations to happen and so forth, but why goats?
Mm-hmm.
And they might come in with an idea that if you really want to improve the community, it must be done this way. You know,
That's a mistake. I just really agree with Marcel Mauss, who's this French anthropologist, who said the primitive reason or way of thinking is not irrational. It's logical. We need to listen to those people. I wouldn't have said no, but I would have been wrong to Pater Sava.
Mm-hmm.
I respected that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, I borrowed this idea
mm-hmm.
and asked the other Hirok participants to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We tried to get money and they start such kind of project. And it still works.
Because for them, goats mean something. They mean something that they don't necessarily...
Absolutely.
I mean, I like livestock, mainly because I never get to see them. I like cows especially.
Right.
They're fascinating to me. I don't think cows like me very well.
Yeah, yeah.
I tried to milk one. Both of us were not happy about the experience.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can understand how, in as much as, you know, certain kinds of things have value to me because of where I grew up, and, you know, this is what gives value. Where I'm living, it happens to be your salary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so your salary is something that gives value in a material sense.
Mm-hmm.
In a material sense, in the community that you're speaking about, goats.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Give value.
Right.
And so understanding and honoring the ethos
mm-hmm.
that is... prevailing in the group itself is really important. I mean, you could have given the women money,
yeah.
but what's money going to do for them?
It's just spent and it's finished.
Mm-hmm.
I think you need to be in the community to realize how this is very effective.
Mm-hmm.
When they do the distribution, they just do it in a way which is, community celebration. Even if I'm not getting a goat, just by watching how they exchange the goat, how they name the goat.
Oh, they
name
the goat.
They name the goat.
Oh, that's awesome.
Really?
Yeah.
They name goat. I know our God is Mahoro.
Yeah.
He is.
Yeah.
Our God is Tujihamwe. Let's come together.
Yeah.
Our God is Dukihamuka. Let's heal from trauma.
Yeah.
Our God is good name, good wishes.
Yeah.
You know, it's the only way we're going to spread the good wishes in our community, our home.
Yeah.
That changed somebody's mentality, way of thinking. I'm no longer stuck in the bad thing, but I can think good. I can just have a future, you know. And people just say, yes. You know, I have a God. That God will give me more keys.
Mm-hmm.
And I will just make sure that I really it's safe.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we need to honor such a kind of ideas and initiatives that come from the grassroots thinking.
You know, I get the sense, and tell me if you feel, you know, comfortable commenting on this, but I get the sense that the TRC, which is what I think most people outside see as being the body that is doing the work of, you know, truth and reconciliation, it's the official body and so forth, that it really doesn't have much relevance in the lives of everyday people.
I would say whenever such a thing would just be done, I would really advise those who will be leading the TRC not to have this intent of, you know, verifying what they knew already.
Mm.
You know, because of what they have done elsewhere, they know it's, you know, happened and so on. And they might just say, let's bring this copy to this country and see what happens.
So in this instance, we're talking South Africa sort of leads the way.
Liberia.
Having a TRC, and then Liberia.
Cambodia.
So like, oh, it worked.
What?
So we're going to do it here.
Uh-huh. Instead, I would just tell them to go there with the intent of working with people. What people do need, what do they want,
mm-hmm.
as a way of getting reconciled, as a way of telling the truth.
Mm-hmm.
What do they need, what do they want themselves, and then accompany them.
Mm-hmm.
That is really important. They need to accompany Burundians, not just to go to tell Burundians what to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's different.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be my advice. I'm sure it's going to take time if they want just to take such a path. But if they want just to say, this is the thing to be done, that can be done in 1 year and 1 month. That's all. But what will be the impact?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm, right. You know, here's something that has come up for me that we haven't talked about before. I'm going to put you a little bit on the spot. But I got a lot of curious questions about Africa.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, the idea that you're speaking about an entire continent as a monolith is one thing in and of itself. But some of the questions that I get asked have to do with men and women.
Right.
And we have talked today about a group of women that are empowered. You know, they're getting these goats, the program is run by women, and they're prospering from it. And these are widows in particular who we started out with. And it got me to thinking about empowerment and about women and men. Maybe we can say sort of sub-Saharan Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Our cultures do share a lot in common. We're Bantu people and so forth. And I think that outside of that part of the world, there really is an idea that, you know, African men are tyrants, man. Y'all are make us suffer.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Give me right.
Exactly. Yeah. And that the women are, you know, really kind of powerless and don't have agency and so forth. Mm. But you're telling a story about women who seem to be displaying an awful lot of agency.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to me a little bit about that. I'm interested in the dynamics.
I'm happy that things are really changing.
Yeah.
As you said, we are in a culture where men seem to have all rights, and they have just to decide for everything, and the women have just to follow.
Mm.
That has been really the case. But now I can tell you, we are just, you know, witnessing real changes. And but still, there are, you know, families where the men are just, you know, the king.
Mm.
I'm not going to say they should just say, okay, women are the queens.
That's not necessarily what people are looking for. I mean,
no,
you know, you
no.
replace one problem
yeah,
with
yeah,
another problem,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah. Just to share, you know, to understand one another and also to vary one another. that's really important. What I see with the initiatives which are conducted by most local organizations, mm-hmm. they make sure that women are included. Mm-hmm. Let's say my program with the healing and rebuilding our community, we ask our healing companion to invite 10 men, 10 women.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what is a healing companion before we go on.
Healing companions are people who are, I mean, facilitators in the HERO program who have had very, very advanced skills in the healing field.
Mm-hmm.
So they are there to help the community to continue with the healing and reconciliation, either by just gathering them or leading such kind of initiative. For example, Pastor Sarah is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So people who have that, you know, creativity of, you know, mobilizing people around one thing and, you know, have just been them staying binded.
Mm-hmm.
So those are.
Why are they called healing companions?
We chose that name not to have a counselor and counselee. We don't have a victim and a healer. We all have been wounded, but still not destroyed. We still have strength. We still have something valuable in us. And maybe today I may be in need of somebody to help me because of my, I'm just really down. And it doesn't mean that tomorrow I will stay down. No. Tomorrow I may be up and somebody else will be in need of something I owe. So in that time, I will just stand up as a healer. So I will say, we are healing companions. You hold me by my shoulder, I hold you by your shoulder, and we walk together.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we came to having healing companions.
Mm-hmm.
So there is not that kind of dependency on one only, but we have interdependency in the healing process.
That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah,
that's a really beautiful thing. And,
yeah.
And it, you know, does allow for the idea that people who otherwise would be seen as you know, professionals, so I must maintain a professional demeanor, and, you know, I'm not going to be one who's cared for myself because I'm a caretaker.
Mm.
So you're making sure that there isn't that sort of caretaker mentality developing in the communities that are using this model.
No.
Yeah.
It will be hard to really serve, you know, kind of a huge community in need of healing when we want to make this individual counseling and so on.
Mm-hmm.
We know, we recognize that all of us, at some extent, have been traumatized. So how can we get out from that?
You know, I wanted to ask as well, because you do this work, you know, trauma is what you do,
right.
in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And there can be a great temptation, I think, to want to forget.
Mm-hmm.
But you're in a line of work where you cannot forget.
Mm-hmm.
So how is that for you, dealing with this all the time?
Not to forget.
Well, no, it's not that you are trying not to forget,
mm-hmm.
but that you are not able to allow yourself to be in a state of denial.
I think when I am in a place where I need just to face the truth,
mm-hmm.
that's where healing starts from.
Mm-hmm.
I look at the thing. I know that it happened to me. And I want just to see how can I tell the story of what happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
How the traumatized person, after having processed inside of him or her, can be able to tell.
Mm-hmm.
That's really where healing takes place.
So telling is important. And even if you have to tell it again and again and again.
Of course. Of course. The more you tell, the better you feel.
Mm.
At the first try, I know, I struggled just to tell my story because it was really so painful. It's like something was just, you know, locking in my throat.
Mm.
Sometimes I just cry only.
Mm.
That's another way of telling.
Mm.
But In other cases, I happen just to remember about that, and I want her to share the same story, and it came out. I also try not just to feel the same as I felt that first time. And then, now, if I'm sure easily, there is no such emotions that come out. Still, I feel bad when I'm just, you know, sharing about my painful stories,
mm-hmm.
but I don't really feel down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, I mean, the memory of the pain is, I have a little bit of an interest, well, more than a little bit, I have an interest in neurology and the ways in which, you know, memory is formed on a biological basis
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
the ways in which we communicate
mm-hmm.
on a neurological level
mm-hmm.
as human beings. Because in my work as a mediator, of course,
mm-hmm.
I want to try to understand these things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing. You know, what scientists are understanding
mm.
about the ways in which we communicate. The fact of the way that you and I are sitting right now,
right.
for example,
right.
and what subconscious messages we are sending to each other
mm-hmm.
that we, you know, of course, don't necessarily recognize on a conscious level,
mm-hmm.
but it's there. So I'm interested in learning these things.
Mm.
And one of the things has to do with how memory is stored,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that even if you reach a place where you're able to tell the story,
mm.
I mean, you're able to tell the story because you talk about not being able to say anything,
mm-hmm.
but then finally reaching the place, but it still has that pain to it. And
mm-hmm.
when we remember these things, I'm beginning to learn, you know, it is as though you relive it. Your brain
right.
relives it.
Right, right.
And so it will always be a little bit painful, and at least a little bit, you know, it'll always be painful.
Mm.
Understanding that that's okay.
Yeah, I think if we can allow ourselves to feel that pain
mm-hmm.
in a place where we are assisted,
mm-hmm.
we are supported, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
I found that the more you think about or you talk about it, the pain you have been feeling,
mm-hmm.
you just, you know, you find people at the end.
Mm-hmm.
I decided to do this. So they are replacing the pain by something joyful. That's amazing. That's the growth.
Yeah.
You know, from the bad thing that happened,
mm-hmm.
one will just make the story,
mm-hmm.
and the story doesn't end with the event. You know, after the event, I saw that this was this and that, and from there, I took this decision, and now I'm doing this. You find there have been a change, not only the bitterness,
mm-hmm.
but there is now goodness of life. After trauma,
right.
See. So I'm just saying the way of getting healed,
mm-hmm.
first, just to be able to frame your story. You just see, yes, that's true. That's my identity. And when safety and trust have been built, you can start talking.
Mm-hmm.
And by talking, you may just say, I don't know how to do. I don't know where to go, but if I keep working on my trauma, I can say, no, I need to do something. What can I do that can give me peace? And the second or third time you tell your story, you're going to ask, after this, I have started to do this and that. It's amazing to see how one really can make such a kind of progression and evolution. So, yeah.
How's your family doing now?
Oh, my family's good. Yeah, they are. Home, my four children are there.
Yeah.
I talk to them often. Of course, they are just waiting me to be back.
You travel quite a bit.
I have been traveling. Now it's gonna be a month that I'm away from home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They miss you.
I do miss them too. Yeah. You know. Of course, we managed to talk on the phone, but not sufficient.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That's
life. The same as being home.
Yeah.
The final thing I want to make sure to do, because I'm interested in, the final thing I want to make sure to do is to talk about your background as a Quaker and how that has informed the work that you do, your approach to it, your dedication to it.
Mm.
I know that healing and rebuilding
yeah.
our communities is sponsored by Quakers.
Right.
So talk to me a bit about that.
My life as a Quaker has been very useful to the work I'm doing and to my commitment. One is our peace testimony.
Mm-hmm.
we are called to make peace with everybody. And we believe that in everyone there is something good. As we say in our Quaker language, there is that of God in everyone. I may consider the person as my enemy or whatever, I still need to remember that in that person there is that of God. So we can make peace. We can come to a point where we have a common understanding. That's really a key thing in my belief. As I grew up Quaker, I was involved in the church management as an elder. We say elders, those who are selected to either manage the church or look after such and such. So the way I was trusted to be with these elder people,
as a young person,
uh-huh. That was really fascinating.
Yeah,
and it made me to listen. You know, I listened on, and I watched what they're just doing. How can you listen to somebody with this non-judgmental attitude, with the intent of helping? You know, that was really significant to me. And that helped me. And also being in a community where people are in need, as a Quakers, we want just to assist those in need. It's another commitment of Quakers. How can we share our resources? Resources, not just material. But I can have these skills to share with those who don't have them. So how can we share? And we do not separate. We don't say, because you're not a Quaker, you're not allowed to attend these workshops. No. We just call everybody. No matter what the denomination, we're together. And we respect one another. Sometimes, in Hiroko workshop, we ask Catholics to lead the prayer.
Mm.
And they are just happy to see. We have been given room in the Protestant church. And that's good for us as Quakers, to hear that people are really appreciating our way of doing things. And that also helped me to understand that we can't all do it. There is no really way of saying, because you are Muslim, you know why to stay with me, you cannot tell me anything about belief and so on.
Mm-hmm.
No. It's not a matter of converting people to your religion. One can just leave his or her religion, but still you can just come together and you can worship.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the few things I can just say about Quakerism that helped me to keep on with this work. But mostly, my mom, she was not a Quaker. She died, it's going to be 2 years or 1 year ago.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. She was not a Quaker, but she had a lot of Quakers. She had a lot of compassion. And I learned a lot from her, being compassionate. As I mentioned at the beginning, she really suffered a lot. For our safety and our well-being as a single parent. Sometimes that helps me, also empowers me to do the work I'm doing. And it takes a lot of my energy and time, but still, I'm enjoying it. As I know that there are many people who are benefiting from it, and people who are still in need of it, you know, the wounds are still bleeding in people's hearts, and we need to do something. Just to offer our time, our energy, our love,
yeah.
It's really essential.
Yeah.
So those are the things which have brought me to loving this work. Yeah. And,
well, I would love to do what I can to help make sure that the work continues. So I want to be sure that people are listening know how they can get in contact with you, learn more about the organization, and perhaps learn about ways in which they can contribute.
Oh, yeah. Of course, We have our website, www.aglifpt.org.
Okay.
If you can just Google African Great Lakes Initiative, you can just find our website, and there is a donation online, and we will appreciate any donation that will come through. it will be every time important and very useful to the project I mentioned and the workshops we are conducting. We would want to serve everybody in Burundi. There are many refugees coming in from Tanzania.
Mm.
They haven't been really integrated in the Burundi society. They are Burundians, but they lived in the exile for more than 40 years. Imagine. So now they are asked to be back home, and they're going to be disoriented in their homeland. So we need to do something for them as well.
Yeah.
So that's why we're looking for people to support the initiative, and we will very much appreciate.
Oh, who knows? I might show up with some goats.
Oh, yeah. Come in. And yeah, of course. We can just pay the refugees and those who stayed in the country.
There you go.
You know.
Oh, for the little goat.
Oh, it's a goat.
Yeah. So it's African Great Lakes Initiative.
Yeah.
Just Google that and they can find out more about everything. Thank you so, so very much, Adrian. I have so enjoyed talking with you. And hearing all that you have to share, these amazing stories. I know I'm inspired to think more deeply about forgiveness and how it benefits not only the person who's forgiven, but the one who's giving forgiveness as well. So I really appreciate your message.
My pleasure. I very much appreciated it, you know, being on the show and also sharing with whoever's going to listen to this.
Mm-hmm.
I very much appreciate the invitation. I really decided to make it. It was not planned, but I said, I want to do it, and we have done it, so I am grateful to that. That's another way of doing another presentation for me.
Yeah.
Don't hesitate. As long as I'm still here, if you need me, give me a call, and I'll show up.
You'll be careful when you say things like that. I have a reputation of taking people up on things like that.
Don't worry, we're going to... We're going to work on our schedule and find how we can do it.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, we're going to end the show today with music, as I like to do. The piece I'd like to play for you is Vijay Iyer, this fabulous jazz pianist and composer. And the piece is Human Nature, and it's his take on the piece by Michael Jackson, Human Nature. And I thought it would be appropriate to play for today. It's from his album Solo, which is available on iTunes and in other places as well. As always, I encourage you, buy the music, support independent musicians, and enjoy. I hope you come back again next week. We're going to have a fresh guest with another story for you for Sangoma, Stories from the Frontlines of Mediation. Have a wonderful week, everyone.